Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Keith Law, senior baseball writer for ESPN and author of the awesome book, Smart Baseball. And we're going to be talking about Connie Willis's To Say Nothing of the Dog, which won the 1999 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So Keith, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, for those few of my listeners who are not sports ball, baseball fans, or, baseball-loving nerds, how about you give a kind of a brief history of your background?
Sure. So I have been with ESPN for almost 12 years now. I am a senior baseball writer. My focus is on prospects. So minor leaguers who've yet to make a substantial impact in the majors, and then draft prospects, college and high school. We can draft high school players in baseball. And a big part of my focus is actually going to see as many prospects as I reasonably can. I do have a limited budget, limited number of days, but I do try to go see all the elite prospects. I actually was just out last night seeing a high school pitcher down in Georgia, and then is supposed to be heading out again later this week to go to Nashville to see a couple of players. And before that, I spent about 4.5 years in the front office of the Toronto Blue Jays, where I started out as a stats guy, as a one-man analytics department. It's kind of a joke now, but
right.
At the time, we were one of the few teams to have anyone doing that. And while there, learned a bit about how the business works, about the scouting side of things, had a couple of mentors there who are still in the industry too. And that helped inform the way I look at players now and break down draft classes or player transactions in the big leagues, which is what powers most of my writing. Then on the side, I do board game reviews for Paste, occasionally do some board game related pieces for Vulture. And like you, I'm an avid reader and write about those and movies and food and other things on my own blog, which is called The Dish at meadowparty.com.
Nice. Yeah, I was going to make sure that that we got a mention of that in there, because I think there might be people who know you through ESPN. And I suppose if anybody follows you on social media, they'd see your Dish posts. But the variety that you bring over there, from restaurant recommendations to lists of music. I love that old list you did on the old school hip hop songs.
Yep.
but then, kind of over all of that is the book reviews. And I've gotten the impression from reading some of your chats and other writing that perhaps you read science fiction more when you were younger, not so much in the last number of years until you got to start reading the Hugo winners. Is that right?
Yes. I went through a long period. So as a kid, I hated the reading we were assigned in school, but would voraciously read the sci-fi. It was kind of an accident. I was in a bookstore, a Walden Books in the Smith Haven Mall for Long Islanders. That'll mean something. and I knew who Isaac Asimov was because I'd read some of his nonfiction books. I remember reading his introduction to a book called Realm of Algebra, which was how I learned algebra when I was in sixth grade. And so I knew who he was, and I saw Foundation on the shelf and was not familiar with it at all, but read the description on the back and said, "This looks awesome." And that kind of set me off, where in a couple of years, I read 20 or so of his novels, a bunch of Vonnegut's novels, stumbled upon Philip Dick shortly thereafter, all of which before I was probably 25 or so, and then just fell out of it. And when I picked back up reading in general, I steered back towards a lot of classic literature. Right. From pre-1950, a lot pre-1900. I went back and read a lot of the stuff I was supposed to have read in high school. I think I have now officially read everything I was assigned in high school. It took me until I was 40 or so, but I did finally get there.
You were probably in a better place to actually appreciate some of those things than you would be in high school.
Oh, very much so. The example I give, and look, some of them, like An American Tragedy, that just sucks. That book sucks. It's terrible. And it's long. It's long and terrible, which is just unforgivable. But then there's a book like Pride and Prejudice, which I could not have appreciated. I read that at six. I was assigned that at 16. I did read it in high school, but I didn't really understand it. I missed a lot of the humor, and I could not understand the moral aspects of the story. Or Tess of the D'Urbervilles, which is actually a beautifully written book that is really, and I think Thomas Hardy is just a tremendous writer, period. But I did not appreciate the quality of the prose, and certainly could not understand a lot of the irony in the book, again, when I was 16, but did when I read that again when I was 33 or so. And Actually, never finished it in high school. I just watched the movie, but then read it as an adult. I was like, oh, this is stunning. And so that kind of led me to say, you know, there's probably a whole world of literature out there that I wouldn't have appreciated when I was younger, but might appreciate now. Right. And at some point, I'm not even sure what triggered me to get on the Hugo's kick. I think I just read a couple of recent ones and said, you know, I still like this stuff. There's still a lot of great writing. Yeah, it's genre fiction, but so what? Mm-hmm. Still a lot of great writing there. And then as I started rolling, I'd say about my hit rate was probably 50-50. I'd say half of the ones I read were great. And to me, if I can, if you give me a list of 60 books and say, you're going to like half of these, that's pretty good. I'll do that.
Yeah. And you had read through like the Time 100 list as well, right?
Yes. Which was one of the, I think that was actually the first of all these book lists that I completed. And that was another one where there were enough that I'd read that I'd liked. And I knew just via email, one of the two guys who'd put that list together, Lev Grossman, whose series, The Magicians, I strongly recommend. It's the fantasy side, not sci-fi, but still absolutely excellent. And again, read through that list and there were enough great new discoveries on it. It's how I found Marilynne Robinson. I'd never read any of her stuff and Housekeeping was on that list. And it's the thing that pushed me to finally read Infinite Jest, which I thought was excellent. Long, yes, but I thought it was worth it. And there were a slew of books on there that I just wouldn't have read otherwise. That's the to me, that's the benefit of finding lists like this, is because I'm a bit of a completist anyway. I like checking off things. I like getting to the end and say, yep, I finished the list. It's not so much, I mean, there's no bragging rights. I'm not going out and, you know, picking up women at bars saying, I've read all the Pulitzer winners. It's just like, it's not really that effective.
Yeah, I've heard that's a good move.
Yeah. So, but it does get me to read a lot of books I wouldn't have otherwise picked up. And it sort of pushes me to expand to new authors or new genres. And to me, that's worth it. That absolutely justifies the time I've spent, even reading some books that were kind of duds.
Now, do you end up reading quite a bit at home, or are you more kind of do it as you travel?
I try to read an hour a day when I'm at home. My daughter is assigned, she's in sixth grade, and she's assigned to read a half hour every night, whatever she wants. So we just let her pick books. I mean, I've suggested stuff for her, but she's now reading something called, I think it's the Lunar Chronicles. It's this young adult sci-fi-ish series that she gets recommendations from friends at school. And so I usually try to set up a half hour to drop everything and read with her. Now we're in baseball season, so it's a little trickier, I will find an hour somewhere over the course of the day today to read, even if it's in chunks. And then when I travel, I tear through. So I just finished George Saunders, Lincoln and the Bardo in like 3 days because I had some flights. And when I'm on a plane, I'd rather not work. I'd rather not break out the laptop.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll watch a movie, but more often than anything else, I'll just read.
Nice. So one thing that I always ask is how many of the Hugo winners people have read. And I think in your case, it's going to be easier just to name the ones you haven't read at this point.
Yes, I have four left. There are 66 winners. I have read 62. I have not read Werner Vinge's A Deepness in the Sky, which was this. He's won three. I've read The Fire Upon the Deep, which I thought was good. It's just long. And The Deepness in the Sky is longer. Mm. So I'm was kind of hoping at some point maybe I'll just pick it up for the Kindle just because of the weight. Because an 800-page book in mass market paperback can be kind of painful. Just because the text gets very tiny. And although I don't wear glasses, I'm 44 now. It gets a little tiring. So that's what I'm actually looking forward to. Then there's C.J. Cherry's Zytene. I just read Down Below Station a few weeks ago and I didn't think it was that great. Right. I don't love her prose. And Zytene is longer. So that was another one. I said, let me just put this off.
It definitely is long. And it's not just long. So I did this one in a previous episode.
Oh, good. Okay.
It's like the size of John Adams, if you've ever seen that book in softcover.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's, you know, it's 600 pages, but it reads more like 1,000.
Yeah. See, that's not my favorite.
Yeah.
And then the two, which you and I have discussed this a little bit before, I have read Kim Stanley Robinson's Red Mars, which won the Nebula, but not the Hugo. Green Mars and Blue Mars won the Hugos. I thought Red Mars might be the worst of all the Hugo winners I've read. It's atrociously written. The prose is awful. The character development is non-existent. He is so utterly focused on getting the science right that he forgot to write a good story.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, it actually, those books inspired one of the best new board games of the past couple of years, which is called Terraforming Mars. There's a physical game with a couple of expansions out. There is an app version coming out very soon for Steam and then later for iOS and Android. The game is good. It's long. Of course, it's complicated and it does focus a lot on the science. But if you're willing to play essentially a 2-hour board game, it's really good. And in the manual for the rule book, the example players, or the names they give in the examples are Kim, Stanley, and Robinson.
So nice.
It's pretty clear what we're doing right here. Like, that works fine. The book stunk. It was so painful, and I could not believe how hard it was to get through. I know people say that They'd Rather Be Right is the worst of the Hugo winners.
Right.
I agree. It's a pretty bad book, but at least I could finish it without excruciating pain.
Right.
And so I have just very clearly left the Robinson books will be the last two. Eventually I'll read Cytene, I'll read Deepness in the Sky, and then I'll decide if I'm willing to put in the effort to read the last two simply for the sake of saying I finished the whole list.
Right. Yeah. Red Mars is one that I gave up on at some point, and I'll have to do it because it's homework for one of my other episodes.
Right.
So.
Right.
I've never been a big fan of Foundation, and Foundation's Edge is one of the Hugo winners. And so I've got a lot of homework for that one. So.
Yes. And that's book four, right?
Yeah.
The trilogy, it's different. I actually think the bulk of the second book in the series, which is almost like a novella within the novel, where the chase for the mule is one of the best adventures I've ever read in any genre. It absolutely flies. I thought it was incredibly compelling. Obviously, you may figure out who the mule is at some point. He tips it off a little bit, but it's a chase. It's just an extended, really fast moving chase sequence. And that it's different than the rest of the series because there's a lot of cerebral stuff. I mean, Asimov was a polymath. So there's a lot of intelligent and philosophical stuff going on elsewhere in the books that doesn't necessarily have that adventure feel. But that portion, I'm totally blanking on the name, but that portion of the second book, that was to me the most exciting and fastest moving thing that I read of Asimov's, and I would say of most science fiction stuff.
Okay, well, that gives me some hope, so I appreciate that. So I'm at 23 winners at this point, so that's
nice.
That's an improvement of 11 over when I started. So, and this was a new one for me. So let's get into talking about To Say Nothing of the Dog. Why did you choose this book in particular?
It was recommended by readers originally. Mm-hmm. They said, oh, I see you're reading some sci-fi. You definitely got to read some Connie Willis. Okay, great. I was going to read them all anyway. And then, so I did this kind of backwards. I read To Say Nothing of the Dog and absolutely loved it. I've since read all four. So Willis has won 3 Hugos for 4 books because Blackout and All Clear were published as 2 books, but won a single Hugo, which is understandable. It's one story. It's just too long to be one book. And I've also read her book, Bellwether. I have Crosstalk on my Kindle. I just haven't read it yet.
Yeah, I just bought that one the other day because it was cheap.
It was on sale, right?
Yeah.
Yes, I saw that too. I absolutely adore her writing. I think she's great characterization. It's so funny. I was shocked to find out she was an American writer because not only she said a lot of her books in England, but she writes like a British author. I see a ton of influence there from early 20th century comedies of manners. She must be very well read in 19th century Brit Lit. There are overt references in To Say Nothing of the Dog to Dorothy Sayers' work. She wrote the Lord Peter Wimsey Mysteries. And this is the title of the book comes from Jerome K. Jerome's 3 Men in a Boat, parentheses, To Say Nothing of the Dog. Well, I had not read the latter book. I read this and then immediately sort of dropped everything and said, I should probably read Jerome K. Jerome's book while this is still fresh in mind. And did, because you get that. That was free on the Kindle. It's from the mid-1800s. And there's no question you're better off if you read both. Now, you could read them in the reverse order like I did. You could read Jerome K. Jerome first. She's drawing very heavily on that. I believe the characters in her book run into those three knuckleheads on their – it's Jerome K. Jerome's book started out. It was supposed to be a serious travel guide sort of story. And instead, it kept getting sillier and sillier, and it turned into a great comedy. And I find that – and so she actually has them run into those three twits as they're sort of sailing down the Thames on an ill-fated boating expedition. And she draws very well on that humor too. Mm-hmm. There, the other books she said in this time travel universe, Blackout and All Clear and the Doomsday Book, which came before, those are serious. They may have occasional comic elements, but those are much more serious novels. This is a comedy. This is very much a comedy of manners with romantic comic elements, a lot like you'd find in P.G. Woodhouse's stories are never this long, mm-hmm. and never this involved.
Right.
But I got a lot of that also from this. So it was almost like she was drawing from many of my favorite authors from a period of really 150 years or so and brought it all together in a very smart, clever, crisply written sci-fi novel. And so of all the Hugos, I have not ranked the Hugos. I will probably do that at some point once I've at least read, maybe I'll skip the Mars books, but at least when I get to 64 instead of 66, I'll actually rank them. This is going to be very near the top for me. And so that's why when you asked me to pick one, I said, you know what, let's pick something that is very, very clearly in my top three or four all time.
Right. Well, in terms of kind of non-spoiler talk about it, other than, I mean, you already talked a bit about the book. Can you give kind of a really brief non-spoiler synopsis?
Yeah, sure. So as I said, this is a time travel book. She started in a story called Firewatch, which I think was published actually in the 80s. She set up this alternate universe where time travel is possible. It has been discovered and it is entirely managed by these researchers, historians at Oxford University. And what she did that was incredibly clever is she set very strict rules around time travel, and particularly that while you can go into the past, the continuum of space-time protects itself. So if you tried to say, well, I'm going to go back in time and kill Hitler, for example, it's the one everyone tries to bring up, right? When you start time travel, would you go back and kill Hitler? It actually won't let you go back and alter the past. If you try to get too close to a certain situation, it will either divert you in time, it'll have you land days, months, even years away from where you were targeting, or space. It will just put you, you tried to go to London and it'll put you in Mexico.
Right. Or put you in a field of marrows.
Yes, exactly. And so this happens, that becomes particularly important in Blackout and All Clear, but that happens here as well. And this is one where these historians are trying to rebuild the Coventry Cathedral for the wonderfully named Lady Shrapnel.
Yes.
Who, of course, is American because, of course, let's make the materialist twit woman an American.
Yes.
And so they're trying to go back and find a specific artifact, a bird stump, and just find out if it was actually there at the point when the cathedral was destroyed during the Blitz in World War II. And so hilarity ensues when they start to try to go back into the past to discover this. Mm-hmm. And the complication is that also, inadvertently, a researcher has brought back a cat from the 19th century.
Which they don't think should even be possible.
Right, exactly. Why was the cat even allowed to come through? Cats are extinct in this future because of an epidemic of feline distemper. Mm-hmm. And so that was Verity, I believe is that historian's name. She has accidentally brought a cat through and they have to try to bring the cat back, so you have sets of historians who are going back to the Blitz. You have historians who are going back to the time of the Jerome K. Jerome book as well. And the brilliance of all of Willis's books like this is that she can thread these different narratives together. She's got three different narratives in three different times entirely, and she manages to make them work together just brilliantly and gets them and even has characters crossing from one into the other and makes it seamless. Yes, of course, you're in different places. The descriptions will change. Some of the characters do differ.
Sure.
But I find it remarkable that she can so smoothly transition the reader from one time to the next, even as characters are moving back and forth, which I would think would be jarring. I think in a less deft writer's hands, that would be particularly jarring to see Verity move from, I don't know what the year is, 1860 or so, to 2057 and back. She manages to make it work extraordinarily well.
Yeah. Yeah, so with this one, I mean, I love that it's kind of genre bending because it has the science fiction aspect of it. And then it also has that, I don't even know what you call it. I think you used a word for it earlier, and now it slipped my mind.
Comedy. It's a comedy of manners. There we go. Very much that good, that element. Now, it's not strictly what it is, because obviously she's got bigger things going on.
Sure.
But it is a comedy of manners. There's a mystery. What the heck is this bird stump?
Right. And what happened to it?
And what happened to it? And then there's strong parody here too. I mean, she's outright parodying Jerome K. Jerome, which was, the book itself was a bit of a parody too. Mm-hmm. She overtly refers to Gaudy Night, which is one of the Peter Wimsey mysteries, which fortunately I hadn't read at the time. And by the time I got around to Gaudy Night, maybe 2 years later, had totally forgotten that it showed up in this book, like forgot everything. And the Wimsey mysteries are also, I would say Dorothy Sayers is one of the authors Willis appears to be maybe not quite emulating, but she certainly derived some of her style from Wimsey, from Sayers, particularly in this book. Mm-hmm.
And this one definitely isn't, I wouldn't call this hard science fiction. Certainly doesn't have any of those frustrating elements about, you know, describing the, what was it, the veil that they call it, that they pull over them, in, or the net, that's right.
She doesn't spend much time on that at all.
No, she doesn't.
She sets up the rules.
Yes, you get the mechanics that you need, but that's all. And I like that.
Yes, and which I think is great. She said, okay, here are the rules of time travel. And she has to tell them again in every book, in every story. But she doesn't spend a ton of time on that. And here are the rules. Here's what can happen. Here's what can't happen. And that's it. And then we're done. We're just going to move on with story. To me, that's the best science fiction.
Yeah.
This is subjective. I understand there are people who read science fiction because they like the world building and they like the let's explore the universe and make new planets. I get it. Totally fine. That's just not for me. I like story, character, great prose. Willis brings all of that.
Yeah. So just kind of in terms of overall thoughts, I mean, it sounds like you're a big fan. And I will say, as a first time reader of this one, I thought it was absolutely tremendous. I had seen that you said it was hilarious. I rarely laugh out loud at a book, but this one had me chuckling over my lunch a couple times. just the whole concept of time lag is so brilliant. And the way it's deployed, and I've got a, you know, kind of a quote later on, more when we get into spoiler talk, I think, but just that whole concept, and that makes it kind of the inciting incident for where everything goes off the rails, because you have this guy who's time lagged and beginning, you know, his mental faculties are definitely questionable, and yet then they assign him something to do and just send him away.
Yes. Yeah. That was the worst idea. Well, but that happens in... So in Doomsday Book is the one she's alluding to. But in Doomsday Book, which is entirely serious, the problem there is the man, the historian, Baudry, I think is his name, who is running the net through which they pass into the past, falls ill with what turns out to be the beginning of a horrible pandemic.
Oh.
As he's passing someone through the net, towards the very beginning of the book. Mm. And so... he knows something has gone wrong, but he's so sick he can't tell anyone or do anything about it. Mm. And so that is a common conceit for Willis is, I've set up this universe with these rules, and now I'm going to mess with it.
Right.
And which she can use for, obviously, here for comic effect and other books for very serious effect. And it works in every case. There's a little bit of that in Blackout and All Clear, where it's a little bit more just functional. They're sending people back into the Blitz. And of course, you're going to struggle to hit your marks when you're going into an area where that is that sort of, I guess in her language, it would sort of be historically dense, where there's too much risk of you messing with history as you send people back into that period. And she's really good at, again, just sort of like, all right, I've set up this perfect little world and I'm just going to poke it. Just that little bit with, hey, here's this time lag that's like jet lag in her universe. This time lagged historian who's going to make mistakes because he's not quite all there and he can't remember, right? That was one of those too, where he just can't quite remember what it is he's supposed to remember. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. So like in terms of recommending this book to someone else, on what basis would you recommend it? You know, fans of what other genres? You've kind of hinted at it, so you don't have to go over long on it, but maybe just reinforce some of that.
This is a book where you can recommend it to somebody who doesn't care for sci-fi, who maybe says, "Well, I don't want to. I don't want to read time travel books." You know, there was a book which I actually have not read, "The Time Traveler's Wife," a couple of years ago that became a huge bestseller. I know it was pretty well received critically, also, that was one where time travel, I guess, was really not, it was essential to the story, but it, you weren't reading this to be a, for it to be a time travel book.
Yeah.
You were reading it because I think it was had a bit more of a romantic element.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So this is, look, time travel is just one of the conceits here. It's just something in the setup, but it is not at, in any way to me, it is not at all a huge part of the, of the book. You're not reading this because it's, because you want to read about time travelers traveling through the space-time continuum. You're reading this because it's really funny. It's smartly written. The characters are great. There is a little romantic element in it too, but I thought it was romantic in the sense that I'm a huge fan of P.G. Woodhouse's books, all of his series.
Right.
Absolutely love them. A lot of his books are romances. I mean, really, that's kind of his main plot device is how to, all right, here's a bunch of couples who should be together, and this couple is going to break up over something stupid, and this couple doesn't realize that they're actually supposed to be together. By the end of the book, everyone gets to the coupling that they're supposed to be in, and we'll figure it out. Well, Willis isn't quite that transparent. He's got other stuff going on, but there is some of that as well. So it's a little bit of that comedy of manners. It's a little bit of the Woodhouse type of comic romance. There is this mystery that we talked about earlier with that bird stump, and there's a bit of the sci-fi element in just enough of it that it's different. You probably haven't read a lot of books like this. I certainly had not. Time travel books I'd read had were often much heavier handed on the time travel stuff.
Sure.
And that's, again, that's fine. That's just not what I prefer when reading. To, you know, your mileage may vary, but I definitely would care. You know, if you told me you can have a book that's heavier on the sci-fi time travel stuff or heavier on the plot, prose, character, I'm going for the latter. That's what I do still read for pleasure. None of this is work for me. And so the fact that Willis, I think she writes beautifully. I love her characters. And many of these characters, Dunworthy appears, I think, in all three of, he definitely appears in all three of the time travel novels. I think he also appears in the story Firewatch that began this whole thing. And so she does reuse a bunch of these characters, which is great, actually, because I really feel like, oh, you read enough of these, you really feel like you get to know them.
Yeah. Well, why don't we go ahead and get into spoilers? So, just kind of freeform discussion, anything you want to talk about this book? I mean, we've kind of already been doing it, but being pretty spoiler light. For me, I just love the, like I said, the time lag and where they're telling Ned, okay, we need you to go into Victorian times. You're going to get a rest there. But before you rest, you got to do this one task for us. And they're prepping him to go to the Victorian times with a subliminal, right? And and so at the same time, Dunworthy is trying to give him the assignment and the description of it. I have a quote here. Ned, listen carefully. Here's what I want you to do. You'll come through on June the 7th, 1888 at 10 a.m. The river is to the left of the dessert fork, which is used for gâteau and puddings. I just, I love that. And that goes on in a couple different, with a couple different characters where he's talking to them and it's getting completely mixed up where he's thinking about, you know, the roles of the single woman in Victorian times. And, it's just a brilliant setup for it to make him completely confused and give him the shreds of information that he can piece together later. But too late to keep him from really bumbling at the start of it.
Yes, that's part of it is that, and that is very Woodhouse-ian, that it's a tiny misunderstanding.
Right.
It ends up driving this huge plot strand because somebody misunderstood something, somebody misheard something, somebody tried some stupid scheme that didn't work out, which you could argue too, there is a bit of a stupid scheme about this also. And I mean, look, there's a convenience that it's Ned, right? Ned is the only one who's available to do this, but he's freaking exhausted.
Right.
He's due for some time off. Wait a minute. It's got to be Ned. We got to send Ned through the net. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't even know at the beginning what he's supposed to be doing.
Right.
And so, which just adds to the hilarity of pushing him into this one situation. It's the tiny things. I mean, this is something that's, I think, true of all of Willis's books that I've read. It really comes through again in Blackout and All Clear, where she manages to get essentially an 1,100-page, two-part novel out of tiny little details, these little mistakes that were made or that weren't even necessarily made, but they just people come through the net in the wrong place. And that's enough. She can do that. I mean, that to me is, it's what an impressive imagination to be able to do that from these very small details that she can essentially bloom this entire garden of plot strands and misunderstandings and comedic elements that, again, just kind of coming through, starting out with these tiny little tweaks.
Right.
And that something just very silly as she created time lag. And then it's just, but then you just roll with it, right? Because he's just freaking overworked. And who doesn't know what that feels like? I can't think straight because I've been in, I mean, hell, how many states have I been in the last 30 days? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, at least 6, yeah. I think. So I'm starting to lose track. You'd add one if you count the fact that I drove over a bridge into Indiana so my daughter could say she's been to Indiana. So, yeah, I'm kind of losing track of things. I know how Ned felt.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I like a book where the plot just kind of surprises you. And I mean, I was looking at this. I'm like, okay, this guy is going to go ahead and get back to Victorian times. He's going to get some rest, and then the plot will happen. But really, it all springs off from there, like you said, because of, you know, little misunderstandings here and there. And the whole concept of slippage, where they recognize there's something wrong, and we think that it's in back in the Victorian times, where maybe you kept this guy from meeting a certain person. Maybe this woman is supposed to meet somebody else who's her mysterious Mr. C.
Yep.
And it just kept me guessing. And I think toward the end of the book, I kind of figured out, okay, I think I know what happened to the bird stump. But that's really not important. It's just a MacGuffin, really, to keep the plot going.
It really is, which is another thing I love. That it's really much more driven by the people.
Yeah.
I mean, we haven't even mentioned Terrence and Tossie.
Right.
The Victorian couple who, you know, sort of that's – oh, so are the, is taught – you know, Terrence is on the boat with Ned. They end up doing their own River Thames trip like the guys in the Jerome K. Jerome book, who they end up bumping into at one point. And again, a bunch of stuff goes wrong as they're sailing down the river. And I mean, there's a point too where it's like, is Tossie real or is this guy out of his mind? And he's traveling to get to – I'm going to say the name wrong. Is it Mutchings End, where he's supposed to meet his lover, Tossie, or his – and lover is probably the wrong word for that era. But again, there's sort of this Woodhouse-ian, will they or won't they? Will they get together? But even but then on top of that, she's layered the whole, you know, wait, who is this Tossie? Does she know he's coming?
Right.
Is this all in his head? You don't know. There's so many little mysteries, not mystery in the sense of a murder mystery necessarily. I think the only big mystery here is what the bird stump is and are they ever going to find it or figure it out.
Right.
But the rest of a bunch of little things that she just doesn't reveal necessarily. So you feel like you're floating along the river, metaphorically and sort of literally, with the characters too. Like Ned gets there and he's kind of not sure what's going on. And I enjoyed that feeling. You don't feel, you know, it's not like it's confusing. You just sort of going along with it, waiting to see what happens, much as the characters would be themselves.
Yeah. I love too that the MacGuffin here, the bird stump, is just so hideous when they finally see it. And it keeps going back to describing. Of course it is. But are those camels? No, those are unicorns. The camels are in the Joseph being sold into Egypt part. And I, with all the descriptions of everything that was on there, I pictured this thing being the size of a truck, because I can't imagine how they fit Neptune's chariot and the parting of the Red Sea and execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, all on one object.
Yes, it is. But that's part of the humor, right? Is that what she's describing is probably not even possible.
Right.
And the more that they layer onto it, the more ridiculous it gets. She does not do that. So that element is not present in the other works, in the other two time travel books in this universe. Bellwether, which is a much shorter novel and does not have a time travel element, is a bit more like this. So I would say if somebody read this and said, I want more of Willis, but I particularly like the comic elements, I'm not so interested in the time travel aspects, I'd say go read Bellwether.
Okay.
Which is more comic, a little bit romance, still has some sci-fi elements, but definitely has a little more of this feel. If you were just going to pluck the comic romance aspects out of this book, that's kind of where Bellwether is for me. I thought it was delightful, but it is not as weighty as the time travel stuff, where she is exploring some larger themes in addition to, in this book, at least trying to get you to laugh. And that bird stump thing, you know, after all the buildup,
right?
You're expecting this objet d'art that is going to be,
you sublime.
Know, right. And it's like, oh no, this thing is hideous.
Yes. Well, and of course, Tossie is just completely enamored of it.
Of course.
Yeah.
What, yes. Right.
Yeah. Much to Bane's chagrin. And I love Bane. He was a fun character too, the butler. And I could only picture Mr. Carter from, I'm sorry, Jim Carter, who played Mr. Carson.
Oh, yes. I had Michael Caine in mind.
Yes.
You know, from the Dark Knight, that sort of butler.
Alfred,
all knowing,
Yes.
You know, very, very upper class, very proper. Yes. Mm-hmm. Any of these. Where, I mean, there's probably a little bit of a Jeeves element, or trying to remember the name of the Blandings butler, although it changes a few times. Beach.
Right.
Beach is in the Blandings novels by Woodhouse. Like, there's, I mean, that's definitely, she's drawing on the great tradition of butlers in British mm-hmm. literature.
Yeah. Yeah, and I liked, too, that there was the, his name is escaping me, Finch, that's right, who had come through from the future, but kind of had found his his role as Jeeves, essentially.
Yes, that was his calling.
Yes. I think it's a tribute, too, to the way she draws characters, that that Cyril the Bulldog was such a compelling character, which is a silly thing to say. But
yeah, so part of the story, too, is in Jerome K. Jerome's book, there is a dog. Mm-hmm. So that story was based on an actual trip that he and some friends had taken down the Thames, and obviously exaggerated for comic effect, too. Mm-hmm. They didn't bring a dog, but what he later said was, let's see if I can even find the quote here, too. As Jerome admits, the dog developed out of that area of inner consciousness, which in all Englishmen contains an element of the dog. So the fact that Willis then turns around and makes the dog more important, I would say, in her book.
Yes.
Not really the center, but certainly more significant in the telling of this story, and where Cyril does become actually a fairly important character. In fact, if you go to the Wikipedia description of this, Cyril even gets a separate line.
Right.
Both Cyril and the cat are listed as characters, and it says, I mean, obviously it's Wikipedia's take for its worth, but both say plays a major role throughout the narrative. Mm-hmm. Not something you often hear about animal characters.
No.
In more serious novels of people.
Right. No, but I loved him. And, you know, Terence just had that kind of constantly quoting poetry. I would have wanted to throw him in the river, I think, just the way he was always waxing poetic.
Oh, yeah. He's a self-parody.
Yes.
And totally unaware of it. I mean, Willis is using him as a parody of the romantic heroes of many of those periods who were expected to be somewhat effete and hyper-literate. And,
right.
I mean, that's the idea of the period. And, of course, that's the funny thing is that Tossie, by the end, although she agrees to get engaged to him, things go in a different direction afterwards, which you're sort of like, oh, thank God.
Yes.
Right? Because this guy's a fathead.
Yes. Well, and the way they go too is with somebody giving it to her straight, right? Correcting her on her terrible taste in art and some of the other some other aspects of her personality that are just less than ideal.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I thought the way that she develops the side characters, which she does in all of her books, I think it's particularly huge in Blackout and All Clear, which I know the reaction at the time was a little less enthusiastic, in part because they were so long. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a lot of people just looked and said, I don't need two books of this. She can write this stuff as much as she wants. I'm going to read it all. Those books are overstuffed with side characters, and they're all good. They're all really well drawn. You can see a lot of her heading in that direction in this book too. I thought the characters, so they were written, Doomsday Book was written first chronologically, then this, Blackout and All Clear, a good 13 or so years later. Mm-hmm. And you can see her developing as a writer too, where her side characters are just getting better and better. I'm referring in this side characters in this universe as the non-historians.
Right.
That they are increasingly well filled out, well defined, and important to the plot. And in Blackout and All Clear, you're really dealing with three historians who are essentially lost, quote unquote, in the Blitz as they've been sent back. So the vast majority of the characters in the book are from the Blitz period. They are actually English persons from that time period. And they're, again, incredibly well thought out, well defined. And you get, I got attached to quite a few of them. I think you can see that development over the course of the three books. I've not read much of her intervening work outside the time travel universe, but you can certainly see just from that her evolution as an author.
Yeah. And Verity was, I kind of fell madly in love with Verity almost immediately. Mm-hmm. Although I'm a happily married man. So.
Yes. Right. I love that it's Verity Kindle, by the way.
Right.
Yes. I don't know if you read this in a physical, I read this in Dead Tree edition too, but I mean, she's playing with names.
Yes.
No question.
Absolutely.
Much as Woodhouse did. I mean, Woodhouse was picking names to be particularly ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But she's also, you know, like I said, Lady Shrapnel.
Right.
I think being the most overtly comic of all the names, Professor Overforce, who's kind of against Professor Pettick. Yes, the two professors who are sort of fighting for a specific professorship at Oxford. And they're both kind of, you know, Pettick the pedant and Overforce the sort of overbearing advocate of social Darwinism. And, oh, hey, by the way, we're talking social Darwinism. Here's another character named Finch. That's probably not a coincidence. And she's definitely messing around with language, which, again, I adore. And I mean, to me, I love wordplay in books, even in serious books, to pick names for meaningful names for characters. I think it's a sign of an author who's really thought further about the work than just telling a good story.
Sure. Well, and that also rewards a reread, right? Because some of these things you're mentioning, I didn't pick up on them. But this is also one of those books where I've looked at some of these that I've read for the first time and I'm like, okay, I'm glad that I checked that one off the list. Where this is one where I'm like, I'm glad that I have this one on, I have it on my Nook. And I'm like, I'm definitely going to reread this one at some point because it was absolute pleasure. And I know there's layers to it that I didn't get on a first read.
Yeah, this is one I'm going to reread. I need to wait a good, I would say minimum of 5 years between rereading because I often remember too many plot details. I lose that greed. Right. Like one thing that really drives me through a book, and I've only reread a handful of books in my life. The Master and Margarita is probably the best example. I read it in college. I went back and read it probably 20 years later. And it held up, thank goodness, because I'm often referred to that as my favorite novel, period, of any time, language, whatever. I'd remembered some things. I remembered some things wrong. So it was good to get the refresher. Rare is the book that is that is so good that I want to reread it and find the second reading as rewarding, even more rewarding than the first. The other example is I don't know if you've ever read any of Jasper Ford's Ford.
I have
the Welsh writer. Okay, so he's these are comic novels with some sci-fi elements. He's got a series, the Thursday Next series, where characters can move in and out of this parallel, this book world, the world of literature. So when books are written, it essentially creates these worlds. He doesn't bother explaining the science of it, thank goodness. But and then this villain in the very first book decides to go in and screw with Jane Eyre, and where Jane Eyre. So where essentially the fire. If you've read Jane Eyre, the fire. Fire happens, and rather than getting saved, the relevant characters are killed off, and the book just ends because he's messed with it.
Yikes!
And that's one where I read that book on my wife's recommendation, but I hadn't read Jane Eyre. I was like, "Well, this didn't work. I think I just missed something." So then went and read Jane Eyre, and then went and reread The Eyre Affair, the Jasper Ford book, and
said,
"Oh yeah, I needed that." That is a little less true here. I don't think you have to read Three Men in a Boat to fully get all the humor. Here, you'll probably like it more if you read Three Men in a Boat, but I think you can very much do what I did inadvertently, which is read Three Men in a Boat right after this. They still work together.
Okay.
But Willis is not assuming that you've read Jerome's book.
Yeah, and I feel like, you know, I've read a little bit of P.G. Wodehouse and some of that. I'm not sure that it necessarily helped, but it put me in a familiar tone. For those sections of the book. And I thought, okay, I like this kind of thing. Just from my previous reading, but no, that's a good recommendation though, to read, Three Men in the Boat. So maybe I'll do that before I give this one a reread.
Yeah. And it's not long and it's very quick. Okay. I mean, I know a lot of 19th century literature can be a bit of a slog. It is not at all. And it's free. So you can, you know, because it's in the public domain, so it stinks. Well, at least you haven't paid anything for it. That's always the worst feeling, I paid $15 for this book and it was terrible. Yep.
Yeah, that's why twice a year our local library here has used book sales, and I go through there with my list of Hugo winners and try and pick up a few on the cheap.
Well, I go to used bookstores as I travel around the country. I go to new bookstores too. And always have a list of, you know, it depends on what I'm doing. It was past Pulitzer winners. It's been Hugo winners. The last time I went to Changing Hands out in Tempe, Arizona, which is one of my favorite bookstores in the country, and had a list of the potential Pulitzer winners for this year, in part because, you know, obviously once it's announced, it's nice to say, yeah, I already read that one.
Right.
But also like, okay, these are the novels that the world has said were, these are the 2017 novels that the world has said were good. And they're living up to it so far. And we'll see. And then maybe the Pulitzers will do what they did a couple of years ago, and they gave the Sympathizer the Pulitzer, and I think that kind of came out of nowhere for a lot of people. And it was very good, too. And immediately I went, all right, okay, I'll read it. You talked me into it.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of the nice thing about lists, like you said earlier, right? If if the hit rate is 50% or something, then that's probably going to work out.
Yes, I'm perfectly happy with that. I look at length. Obviously, it matters if I've read that author before and know I do or don't like his prose. Yes. Or her prose. Certainly if the publisher's come out and it's a book I've never heard of, it's 250 pages, I'm just going to go buy the
right
book. If it's terrible, it's still over fast.
Yeah. Well, anything else about this book that you want to talk about, Keith?
No, I think we've covered all the high points. I mean, again, I love a good comic novel. Mm-hmm. This is a very old fashioned comic novel. I find that a lot of modern comedy, and this is not just true in books, but in film and television as well.
Yeah.
There's a bit more of a reliance on gross out humor or what is I've heard called cringe comedy. Sure. This is old fashioned comedy, and this is very much my favorite mm-hmm. type of comedy, particularly in comic writing. Where it is very much situational and somewhat dialogue driven, and it's intelligent. It's really talking up to the reader, and that's the other reason I would recommend it. I don't think you need any background in any of this. You don't have to be a sci-fi reader. You don't have to have read the Jerome K. Jerome book. It's just a funny book that really stands very well on its own.
Yeah. Yeah, I told my wife, who is not at all a science fiction fan, that she would probably enjoy this one. She's like, time travel? And I'm like, no, seriously, you should try it.
No, it's not. That's just the setup.
Right.
It really is just the setup. It's such a small part of it. I mean, this was, what was it, like Forever War or Gateway, the Frederick Pohl book. Mm-hmm. There are books in these Hugos that are almost entirely about the science fiction
yes.
part. Like the guy who wrote it was very enamored of, I've come up with this world. Right. Let me do all these things. Like Gateway was a fine book. There's actually a serious little story in there.
Yeah, I like that one.
Oh my God. Oh, but I mean, there was just so much explanation of the setup and the science. I don't need to go to all these places.
Sure.
You know, and eventually then I start thinking too much about the impossibility of the science in it.
Right.
I understand like faster than light travel, not actually possible.
Yes.
But we're going to just accept that as part of the story. I can accept that mm-hmm. for a little bit. But the more time you spend on that stuff, the more it's going to bother me that I know it doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
So, and this has none of that. She just sets up the time travel thing and then just tells the story, which is delightful.
Yes. Well, that's kind of by way of final thoughts. I think that's kind of what we've been doing here. I thought this one was tremendously enjoyable. I love the fact that it blended science fiction really skillfully with that, like you said, comedy of manners. And it was just hysterical in places. So definitely a strong recommend from me as well.
Excellent. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Now, before we sign off, Keith, is there any hope for the Mariners?
Well, they weren't actually no hit. The night before we were reading this podcast,
right?
We were doing this podcast, so it was, which was a possibility for a little while.
Yes,
there. I think they unfortunately may have topped out. I don't know that there's enough upside in this roster to say they're going to make the playoffs.
Yeah.
This year or next, and the system is pretty barren. I mean, I think Jerry DePoto was hired to try to squeeze a playoff team out of this while Cano and Felix are still there.
Right.
It hasn't worked.
Nope, it has not.
And unfortunately, that means that there's going to be a painful rebuild probably in the near future.
Ouch. Well, that's no fun.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for the good news.
Yeah, that's why I'm here.
Yeah. So before you sign off, any social media links, any place you want people to find you?
Yeah, I should promote myself, yeah. Right? It's funny. I got good at that briefly, and then I just completely stopped. So folks who want to read my non-baseball stuff, the website is meadowparty.com/blog. It's called The Dish. It is, anything I write non-baseball probably appears there. And I do link frequently from there to stuff I write for other sites. You can find me on Twitter at Keith Law, on Facebook at Keith Law Writer. I do occasionally post on Instagram. It's often pictures of food,
right?
Or occasionally as I'm sort of playing the tourist and out and about seeing baseball players, I'm MR Keith Law. So Mr. Keith Law. On Instagram. And my book, Smart Baseball, actually just came out in paperback about 4 weeks ago today.
Yeah.
Like 4 weeks ago. Exactly.
Yeah. I think I have it. I have the ebook version of it, but I might pick up the paperback one just so I can throw it at my neighbors who are more into traditional stats than I am. So
yes. And arguing about
yes.
Players getting saves and wins and RBIs.
Right.
And, oh, that was a good bunt. Nope. Yeah. No such thing as a good bunt. Stop talking.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, Keith, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you. I've been a huge fan of your work for a long time. I'm sure you don't get tired of people saying I pay for Insider just so I can read your stuff. And
thank you.
And I love reading also all your book reviews. And so can't thank you enough for taking the time. I know you're really busy this time of year, and I'm sorry that this is when it ended up being.
That's okay. No, thanks for having me. It was a real pleasure. All right. Take care.
All right. Bye.
Yep. Bye.
Well, everyone, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Keith. I've been a huge fan of his writing over at ESPN and on his personal site for years. So I'm going to put all the links to all that kind of stuff in the show notes. Definitely check out Smart Baseball if you're a baseball fan, because it does a great job of describing, you know, kind of why the older traditional stats just aren't that interesting, don't provide that much information that's useful. Whereas some of the newer stats, and he kind of walks through the newer stats and explains, here's what this does, here's why it's useful. And then also goes in to talk about kind of the future of baseball analytics with StatCast and some of that stuff and the amount of data that's out there, which is just insane. So definitely a high recommend from me, because I'm a nerd who loves science fiction, but I also love baseball. So, and it was kind of a dream come true to get to talk to Keith. So if you enjoyed this, I encourage you to please share it with your friends. I'm assuming if you're listening to this, you may have nerdy friends yourself. So please share it with them. Give us a like on Facebook or a follow on Twitter. Both of those are at Hugo's Podcast. And leave us a review if you would like. And I think that's about all the time that I will take for today. So thank you so much for listening. Talk to you later. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.